Welcome to Your Music Saved Us, where two friends blast ourselves into the past to relive and recontextualize the alternative Christian music we grew up listening to in the 1990s. My name is Jay.
And I'm Clifton.
And Clifton, what are we listening to this week?
Well, according to Frontline Records, we're listening to a rockabilly album.
Great.
I don't agree with that, but they also, however, described it as quirky, clever, and machine gun fast, which I do agree with because that describes, I think, Rainy Day's Homecoming.
Nice. Well, and I have an answer to this, but I want to hear from you. How hard was this to find?
It's actually surprisingly easy to find on the internet for how possible it is to find out anything about the album. It's available on Spotify and SoundCloud. You can download it for free on Bandcamp.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all over the place.
Yeah, fair enough. And I guess we'll get into how hard it is to find anything about the band. But yes, to hear this album, it's very possible.
Yeah.
Finding anything about them is more of a challenge. Yeah. So take us into that. What have you found?
Rainy Days is not a great band name for the internet age, and only having put out one album, Homecoming isn't a particularly unique album name.
No.
So the only mention I could find of the band or the album on the internet, besides some, you know, cursory info on Discogs or Christian Music Archives, is from an interview that Jeff Jacoy, he's the bass player for Rainy Days and vocalist for Unashamed at the time, did with Indie Music Vision in April 2007. I'm going to read it to you. It's one paragraph. After being asked if people from Unashamed continue playing music, here's what he said. Jason was doing Supertones, and everyone knew that it was going to be huge when they started playing. Dana was playing in Mend. I was playing with some of the Bloodshed kids in Rainy Days, and was doing this band called Resolve with Tim Mann and some of the Centerpoint guys.
And that's it.
That's it. He makes a similar mention to Rainy Days in an interview he did on the As the Story Grows podcast, which I really recommend listening to. It's episode 154. But that's really the only mention of the band out there, even, I mean, in magazines. And now, given that, we can talk about the people in the band, since that's probably a little bit more important since they recorded one album and seemingly ceased to exist. So the vocals are Sean McCauley, and as far as I can tell, there's no other activity from him at this time. On guitar was Jason Fleetwood, who was in Bloodshed and went on to be in Fan Mill, and later on in a band called Windowsill Audrey. On guitar is Sean Stopnick, also in Bloodshed, then went on to Stairwell, and more recently, Rock Kills Kid. On bass, we have Jeff Jacoy, who was in Unashamed, and then went on to be in Found, Never Alone, Resolve, and Tetzel Would Be Proud. And then on drums, we have Jason Feltman, who went on to be in Fan Mail and Value Pack, the Deluxe Stone Rockets. Those are the guys. So a bunch of Bloodshed guys, Jeff from Unashamed, Jason Feltman, who was a drummer for several bands, and then Sean on vocals, who, as far as I can tell, didn't do anything else at the time.
So
there is a little bit of trivia I have about the album.
Yeah, tell us the trivia.
The album is produced by Luis Garcia, the bass player for Point Guy.
I noticed this.
It's engineered by Eric Tokel, who went on to play bass for Fan Mail. That's kind of weird.
Mm-hmm. And where was it recorded?
The green room.
Yeah.
As in most things in this era, right? From Christian music.
I think.
Or Christian alternative music.
I never paid attention to that until we did this podcast, you know.
Oh,
and
really?
Now, I remember the name, but I didn't kind of look at where is this album recorded on everyone, but almost everyone we've covered, but green room.
Everyone in California recorded at Gene Eugene's green room.
Yep.
It seems like. Yeah.
What's your first experience with this album? Kind of what's your oldest memory with it?
As far as I can tell, on Bandcamp, where it was uploaded by Jeff Jacoy, it says the album came out in June 1996. I probably found it not terribly long after that. I think it had a sticker on it that said, you know, it had members of Unashamed and Bloodshed, so I listened to it when I noticed that. I remember sitting at Mardell, that's the Christian bookstore in my hometown, and listening to this album over and over and over, because I was actually pretty young when I found this, and I really couldn't afford to buy it at the time.
Similar memories. Pretty sure I either found it at the Christian bookstore, and I'm like you. I'm almost positive there must have been a sticker on it that said members of Bloodshed and Unashamed. Either I found it there or I read it. Mm-hmm. They ran some ad in HM or something I was already reading and knew to expect it. And just, I'm pretty sure I think I bought it without even listening to it just because it had that sticker on the front. But yeah, same time period, probably would have been 96 as well. You brought up one memory of sitting in the bookstore listening to it. What other memories do you have? Kind of how did you feel about it at the time?
So I absolutely love this album in high school and into college. I don't listen to it all the time, all that often these days, but I do still listen to it sometimes. At the time, as a very sheltered 16-year-old, I thought that it was mind-blowing that this was a punk band that didn't use heavily distorted guitars, which seemed like the most punk thing ever to me, you know, to subvert one of the core elements of punk and still pull it off. So, I thought that was pretty radical.
Okay. Just from your memories, we're going to dive into songs in a minute, but just from your memories, any songs that stood out to you?
I remember all the songs on the album.
Wow.
Because I've listened to it since the 90s, you know. You know, I remember the album being kind of quirky and dark. I remember Goodbye seeming a bit judgmental at the time. Well, I'm going to say I was worried about how it was going to come off, you know, digging into this. I don't remember having a favorite song from the album, although I do remember being particularly taken by, of course, The Last Voyage of Sir Patrick Spence, to the point that I had to memorize a poem once in English class. I memorized The Fool, which this is only a part of, but The Fool ballad in Middle English, and recited it in English class. And then the next year, my freshman year in college, when a online friend pointed out to me that my AOL Instant Messenger screen name, which was something like Punk Blaster at the time, didn't fit me very well, I started using Sir Patrick Spence as my username.
I remember this.
I have one more memory to talk about. So this is a kind of awkward memory related to Rainy Days. So I was visiting back home from college. Some friends of mine were putting on a show. Maybe Stairwell. I don't remember though at the time really. But obviously one of the Rainy Days guys was in one of the bands. I don't remember who. After the show, we were at a Taco Bell buying the band food. So, you know, the entire band's there and me and some friends and some other people I didn't know. My friend keeps pestering me to tell the Rainy Days guy how big a fan I was. And I didn't want to bug him, of course, because I don't know. I've always thought there's no point in telling someone that you're a huge fan, because, like, what are they going to do, you know? So eventually my friend just blurted out, "Clifton's a huge fan of Rainy Days." And the guy kind of looked at me awkwardly, and I looked at him awkwardly, and he went back to eating. Yeah, that's it. And that's why it's really awkward to just say, "Hey, I'm a fan."
Do you look back on that moment with regret?
I think if I met someone that I was a fan of today, I'd probably be more inclined to say, like, thank you, than just, you know, I'm a fan. But, you know, other than that.
I want to jump back, and I know we'll talk about the song in a minute, but if it's okay, I want to jump back to your memory of quoting the poem from Sir Patrick Spence. And I guess my question is, how did you even know the origin of that song? Because if I check now, if I remember correctly, I don't think it indicates in the lyrics that was from something else. And in fact, I was going to point this out, in the lyric book it says, "All songs written by Rainy Days." And I thought, there's a couple other points in here where I think they're taking some liberty with that. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But yeah, how did you even realize that that was part of a bigger poem?
Probably the fact that it's not in modern day English, even in here, probably tipped me off to that there was something different going on here. And so I probably just looked for it. While I didn't have computer at home at the time, and I didn't have internet access at home at the time, I did have internet access at school. So I probably, you know, looked it up at school.
This is, though, that's pretty good, because this is 98, 99, mm-hmm. right? If it's your senior year of high school. So mm-hmm.
Yes.
Even with the internet, there's, you know, it's not what it is today, obviously, and
right,
like the amount of choices. So I'm impressed you found it regardless.
I was in a library, you know, so I had access to like library resources.
Okay.
And it's an old ballad, you know. It's a very popular ballad, actually. You know, it wasn't that hard to find.
What did you expect before you sat down for this podcast and listened to it again? Because I know you've heard it since then, but what were your expectations? And then I guess, did it measure up? Like, what was your impression when you started listening to it?
I guess I expected to live up to my expectations, in that I didn't expect it to be amazing, but I expected it to be a solid and somewhat clever punk album. And this is important, in a not entirely traditional punk rapper. You know, the fact that it's not just full-on distorted guitars and screaming and whatnot. But I think it lived up to what I expected. Obviously, we'll talk about this more as we explore the album, but I was not disappointed.
All right, well, let's jump in with some of the songs. It starts off with Wayo.
Yeah.
Which I will say, I do think it's a nice way to start off this album, but give me your thoughts.
Yeah, so the album starts off with this kind of like old-timey guitar and some snapping before some drums come in. Mm-hmm. my first thought is, okay, look, I get why it's tempting for the label to classify this as rockabilly, because there's this kind of certain sound to it, but this is not a rock. Like, there's nothing rockabilly about this. I don't know what I would categorize that kind of first intro as. You know, it's very white musically, I'll say that. You know, it's not blues influenced at all. But I would say maybe it's like a more 90s interpretation of maybe the late 40s, early 50s, like young white people pop. Except they didn't use guitars back then, but, you know, something similar in tone to that. It's also reminded me of something that I forgot about, which is something that happens several times in this album, is that there's kind of these like 45 to 50 second pre-songs. I don't know what we
Yeah, you're right. It happens in quite a few of the songs.
None of the lyrics for these pre-songs are written up. And this one just says something about Samantha. And I think it says she lived on her back. What do you think that means?
I don't know.
I mean, for me, that has sexual connotations.
Right, but I don't think that's what they meant based on the rest of the songs.
I don't think so either. Yeah, there's a Belle and Sebastian song that mentions someone living on their back, but it has to do with, like, being injured. Anyway, so the actual song begins, and it starts going fast. I tapped out the beat on my metronome, and it's something around 280 beats per minute, which is about the same as like MXPX's Punk Rock Show, for example, which is another fast song.
Mm-hmm.
Just for reference, a typical dance song is around 100 to 110 beats per minute.
Okay.
This is you know, they do get going on this album. I'm reminded immediately how much I love the cadence of the singer's vocals, how much I love the backing vocals. They do a lot of kind of harmonizing on this album with the backing vocals, which is very nice. As well as some more kind of like random backing vocals, which I'm going to guess that Jay thinks is silly, but I'm going to say was interesting to me. It's done other places in a similar way, including, like, you know, Weezer's Pinkerton, I think, has very interesting backing vocals in that same kind of random kind of way. I don't want to talk about vocals right now, because I want to talk about the guitar tone, because that's the first thing that hits me as the music really starts going. And I think it's worth talking about to really set the mood for this album. So as I mentioned earlier, these aren't normal punk distorted guitars. There's two guitars, a lead guitar and a rhythm guitar. Both guitars have just enough overdrive on them to give them a little sparkle and flavor, but not enough to actually distort the guitars. In guitar world, overdrive is kind of a very soft distortion. So the rhythm guitar is playing kind of a typical punk power chords. The lead guitar is playing a pretty constant kind of riffs. In that sense, it's very typical punk in what the two guitars are doing, but with clean guitars, so you hear a lot more detail, a lot more nuance than you normally would. The other thing that's weird is kind of that the lead guitar is kind of front and center in the mix, basically as loud as the vocals and louder than the drums. And his riffs are somewhat simple, and they're very rhythmic, honestly, for being a lead guitar. But at least for me, it's very effective in setting the tone for each individual song and for the album overall. I liked it.
I will say, for me, this is probably my favorite song on the album. And I remember even when I was a kid and got this, I remember being like, I like the first song. And then after that, kind of like, not really getting the rest of the album.
Yeah.
If it's not too early, I did kind of want to touch on the lyrics of this one. And this brings up to me something I kind of hope we'll address in other episodes as well. But this is that got that like kind of really like militant Christianity vibe in it. Like, we're your soldiers, my Lord. One by one, we're taking back the souls of the people you created. We fight your fight that you already won, blah, blah, blah. I did think it was funny that he said, we call in special ops and let the sneaky boys take that mother down. I found it interesting, the use of mother in this song. But this is something that I, reflecting back on growing up in evangelical church, did not realize like how kind of inundated we were with this mindset and this language.
That's something I wanted to talk to you about, is what you thought about it at the time and what you think about it now.
Yeah, so at the time, it was like, yeah, okay, we are, you know? Blah, blah, blah. And I think you really see this in definitely some hardcore bands and stuff, too, like Unashamed and other stuff. But it really is in everything. I mean, you like Christian pop.
Oh, yeah.
You would hear this, too. I mean, I remember growing up and, like, put on the armor. I've got, like, singing songs about it. As a little kid, I remember I had, like a little plastic armor set that we got at the Christian bookstore that was like the sword of, you know, whatever they all are.
Okay, that's funny.
I don't even obviously I don't remember it. I just thought it was cool because I could get this little armor set with a sword, and sure. It was somehow okay. I think this is a real like kind of problem of evangelical Christianity. And just as a side note, but to plug it a little bit, I just recently read this book called Jesus and John Wayne, and it's I really recommend it to people because it talks a lot about. I mean, the book kind of it came out this year, and so people are looking at it as like an answer to why did Christians support Trump? But it really goes a lot before that, and was just saying like, look, evangelical Christianity was already there. Trump's just almost in some ways like kind of the natural next step for everything they've been promoting. And the thing she really addresses in the book is kind of this patriarchal militant Christianity that goes back through like Focus on the Family and even before that. But then she talks about books like, I don't know if you remember that book. It came out, I think, when we were in college, Wild at Heart by John Eldridge, and just this kind of like really masculine Christianity stuff. And so I saw that in this song. It reminded me of that. And I saw it a couple other places in this album. And I think as we're looking at other albums, we're going to see this again.
Yeah.
It's an interesting song. I still think it's probably my favorite song on there just because it's short, it's fast, it's catchy. Mm-hmm. Don't like the lyrics now, really, at all.
My first note is, I didn't really question this kind of warmongering Christian rhetoric at the time, probably because it was so common.
Yep.
You know? And yeah, as you said, it's just it's literally everywhere, and it's not even questioned. One thing it made me think of is, this is obviously many years later, but it's still in that same culture. That's just a continuing culture. And really, when I started to question this kind of rhetoric was, you know, the 2003 invasion of Iraq and Bush's kind of grotesque shock and awe strategy. I remember my pastor at the time did a sermon that wasn't about the Bible, and it wasn't about Jesus, and it wasn't about faith, and it was literally a sermon about the weapons being used in the invasion.
Okay.
Yeah, it was just like weapons porn as a sermon. He literally stood up at the pulpit and kind of with glee described the weapons, including one of the Moab, kind of the colloquial term for it is mother of all bombs, though that's not really the real name for it. It's basically the biggest bomb that you can have that's not nuclear. But yeah, I just remember them describing with glee kind of these weapons and the destruction that's going to be unleashed on God's enemies, you know, due to them. That's... that was probably the first time that I really noticed kind of how embedded that kind of militaristic thinking is into American evangelicalism. So I do want to agree with you real fast, though. You know, this song, I think it comes off as both like clean and raw at the same time. I want to say that I think that guitar tone is part of that. Because of kind of the transparentness of the guitars, it lets that kind of rawness of the music come out to me more, and kind of like, I don't want to say desperation, but kind of, you know, this just wanting to put this out there.
You're right. I don't like the background vocals on a lot of the songs. I do like the background vocals on this song. I think they work well. Yeah. Let's go to the next song, and it's called Cha Cha Cha. And just to preface it, because I want to hear your thoughts, but this to me is a good example of kind of my overall thinking on the album. I've kind of been like scratching my head as I've been listening to it, because I'm just trying to decide how much of this is serious and how much of it is not. But obviously some of the lyrics are serious.
Yeah.
But when am I supposed to be taking it seriously? How seriously did they take this? Because the song is not flippant,
nope.
But then it's got cha-cha-cha every so often, and I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Like, what is the point? So I guess this is kind of my overall thesis for thinking about the album, is just this throughout. Is this serious? Is it a joke? I don't really know.
As a kid, I remember thinking about this, and, you know, why was the cha-cha-cha there? Was it, there's basically two options to me. It can either be like a corny songwriting crutch to fill in space, or what I figured at the time was that maybe it represents a person, you know, maybe trying to get through life, pretending that things are going well, but honestly is really faking it, just kind of doing a dance, a performance kind of thing.
I could see that. I could also see your first reason too.
Yeah, they can both be true. But yeah.
Okay, so tell us more about this song.
I really like this song, you know, as a kid, and especially, you know, like I said, I've always liked dark and quirky things, and it's especially as I think I went into college and I started struggling with anxiety issues, you know, that went undiagnosed for years. This song, I think, really stuck with me through those years. It's kind of, like I said, it's kind of a dark song. The lyrics start with, months I spent in my despair, sick of the world, cha-cha-cha. I'm not going to say that anymore.
See what I mean?
Day by day, my hell increased. released Mad at the World.
Cha-cha-cha.
As it progresses, the writer prays for life to be better, but instead of getting better, things get worse. So later on it says, my prayers were answered just last week, got hit by a bus. God said to me, you stupid kid, life ain't so bad. And then it goes into, now I understand this place, but I'm still at war with the world. Now I've got a new reason and a smile, and I'm having a blast. Cha-cha-cha. It's kind of weird to read the lyrics in the book. They do come off, I think they come off more corny in the book than they do in the song. I think if you listen to them in place in the song, they come off very serious. This guy is actually, I think, either our age or you're younger than us. So, you know, he's a kid at the time he's writing this. I'm not going to expect him to be a lyrical genius, you know? and especially that, considering that this is the only band that we know that he was in at the time. It's not amazing lyrics, but I think when combined with the vocals in the song in place, I think they're really effective.
So when he's like,
God said to me, you stupid kid, life ain't so bad, cha-cha-cha.
Yeah, so the corny voice.
Yeah, right? The corny voice. What is this about? Because again, I'm having a hard time going, are we taking this seriously? Are we not?
So I describe this as an adult in a cartoon cheesy voice that they do for God here. I remember finding it fun at the time. It's one of the quirky things about the album. Is it silly? Absolutely. I think you're going to have a hard time arguing that nobody in the punk world was doing silly things at this time, though. So I don't know how to take it. This voice comes back a couple times, not as God, but as just this voice comes back. You know, maybe they were having fun while they were doing this. Maybe they didn't think about it as much. I don't. It's hard to say, right? But it is weird. It does catch you off guard. Maybe another side of it is that people take the voice of God too seriously, and they were trying to be kind of quirky with it.
What about when he says, "Now I've had my look around"? This is kind of the chorus. And in the lyrics, I've noticed with this album especially, they deviate a lot on the album from what's written down.
Mm-hmm.
It says, you really got me, babe. But I think he's saying, now I've had my look around, you really got me, baby.
He says, baby.
Yeah. What is that about? Is he talking about God as in baby?
I think he's talking about God, yeah.
Okay, God as his baby.
I mean, obviously that's corny, but I think he's saying that I'm not questioning, you know, what's going on now kind of thing. Like, I've looked around and I'm not questioning things so much.
Okay.
Which is another conversation. I find this song a little bit disturbing, especially the part where the guy's life is hard, he prays for it to be better. But this is a very common idea in Christianity that, you know, that when your life is hard and you pray for it to get better, God might make it harder just to break you to open your eyes.
And I took this song as one of those, almost like a near-death experience, because God says, I'm giving you a second chance. And he says, so remember the time you spent here with me, like, oh, you've been dead for a few minutes in heaven, but I'm kicking you back down to earth.
Very possible. Yeah, so it reminds me of a story that I heard, you know, as a kid, around the same age, honestly, of an older guy in our church. I remember him telling us this story when I was a counselor at a camp, and he was telling us this story, kind of just the other counselors, that he found God. You know, he had a family, you know, child and kids, and he was happy, but he didn't go to church, and his wife died, and then a few weeks later, both of his kids died, and it really broke him, and he almost died, and then he turned to God. It kind of reminds me of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which I think even at the time I found that to be disturbing and a weird message to come from Christianity that you need to be broken. I mean, that's what cults do. Cults need broken people, right?
Yeah.
Like, because they need them to not question anything and they need them to be susceptible to their teachings. They don't need whole people. You don't become a member of a cult because things are going great in your life.
Yeah, true.
That about this song disturbs me.
Well, yeah, I'm... Yeah, this was a song...
Heavier than you thought we were going to get?
A little bit, yeah. Again, I think that was my problem with this album, and I think I even felt it when I was a kid, of like, this seems like a joke to me. I don't really think they know who they are or what they're doing. Okay, blah, blah, blah. I've listened to it a few times. I'm done. So it's interesting to hear your take on this stuff. Let's go to the next song, Homecoming, which is the title of the album. And I'll be honest, this... When you think of homecoming, this is not what you think of.
Nope.
And so I'm curious even why the song is called that, why they chose this for the album title. Like, I don't know, what did you think of this song?
It's a very good question. Even the lyrics for the song don't make a lot of sense to me. The
right.
So first off, yeah, so the song's about a race.
Yeah.
And which they kind of pull off well, because, I mean, the song just starts. It just goes immediately right out the gates. It's even faster than Way-O. The weird thing about the song is the lyrics are about being in a race and how they're never going to go home again. And then all of a sudden, it's just like, I can't wait to get home.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I thought this is another one where the chorus style and kind of the background vocals, so this is more like, I guess, gang vocals at the chorus were really weird to me. I didn't know what to think. And again, I wrote down, is this a joke? What are they trying to do here?
So this is the song I wanted to say for talking about the vocals, because I like the vocals in this song. Partly because it has a lot of different kind of vocal things going on in it. Sean, I think it's worth mentioning, the lead singer, he has a really good voice from kind of a gruff and screaming to just a singing. And he's very good at going back and forth between the two. I think he's very effective at that. You know, and as I already mentioned, I really like his cadence, and I think it works well in contrast and in rhythm with the songs at different times. There's really good background vocals on this song. Between the verse and the chorus, there's kind of a pre-chorus or a bridge, whatever you want to call it, where there's kind of harmonizing backing vocals. It's three parts, and it... You know, and if you think about other bands at this time that were doing harmonizing vocals in the punk genre, you know, whether it be Goaty Hook or MXPX, things like that, this is better than all of them. You know, there's three parts, and it's a more nuanced harmonizing than all of those. I think it actually works really well. And then, yeah, we get to the chorus, and there's these gang vocals that are just saying, we're going home, or something like that. And it is a bit silly. I think this is a sillier song. You are bringing up something here that I think I'm way more used to than you because of the kind of music I listen to.
True.
Which is kind of these silly vocals with not silly lyrics, right?
Yeah. No, that's a good point.
I listen to a lot of Twee and other indie pop from Tollycraft, Dark Texture, and Helsinki, where it's very common to sing about very dark things in a happy-go-lucky way, you know?
Right.
Today, I'm not as shocked by that. I think that's one of the things I found delightful about this album at the time, is that it does have that, it has a darkness to it, but that darkness doesn't overcome, it doesn't take over the album. The album still stays fun and it still stays quirky. For me, I don't know why, maybe this darkness has always been inside of me and I've always had to deal with it, but dealing with darkness in a quirky way is a delightful thing because it's there. Your choice is to be quirky about it or to be overcome by it.
No, that makes sense, especially with your comparisons of the Twee groups and stuff. I just wonder, at the time, I have a hard time thinking these guys were into like Twee pop and stuff.
Why? I mean, but Twee, around this time is when Twee was having its closest experiments with punk. You know, Tollycraft's first album came out in 94. Their earlier band, Crown, was out in, I forget, 92, 93. And they weren't called Twee at first. They were called Cuddlecore because it was more of a punk rock sound with these Twee-type lyrics and vocals. All that was going on in California and up along the West Coast. I don't think it's insane to think that they heard that they experienced this at that time.
Okay, you may be right. That may be a direct influence then.
Yeah, and you know, these guys are coming from hardcore bands. The fact that they want to do something a little bit sillier is not surprising to me either.
Well, I did get that sense for sure. I mean, that's one of my thoughts on this album, is that this was definitely a break. Like, these guys got together, let's do something completely different.
Right.
And that's kind of how this came about.
And that's something that Jeff even talks about in that As the Story Grows interview, is that as Unashamed was kind of falling apart, that one of the things that took them apart was that, you know, they'd done the hardcore thing and they wanted to do vastly different things at this point.
Let's talk about Aubrey's Fall, which I think is the next
it is.
Song on the album. So give me your thoughts first.
To set the scene, this could be hardcore songs if there was distortion, but there's not. And they keep that same kind of playful lead guitar going, and so you don't get that out of it. Although that playful lead guitar is less apparent here because it's doing an arpeggiated thing, which is basically forming chords, but one string at a time, one note at a time. It doesn't come off as much as on any of the other songs. I personally really like this song, even though I have a lot of problems with it today. Which we'll talk about. I saw in your notes the same thing that I had a problem with in this. At the time, I remember reading the lyrics for this album, but I don't remember this song. I remember at the time, there's a part that says, put that gosh darn glass down, which I thought was pretty funny, instead of cursing.
Right.
Although it's written darn in the notes, he definitely says darn. Put that gosh darn glass down. I also think that musically, this is actually one of the songs that does get a little bit darker. You know, the guitars, the vocals, the backing vocals, kind of two layers of backing vocals, I think really comes together. I think this is probably the first time they actually get dark and pull it off in the album, but in a way that's not like a bummer. It's still moving fast. It's still a fun song, but it does kind of communicate that more of that darkness. I think one thing that may be rubbing you the wrong way also is, so in addition to liking, you know, twee and indie pop and that kind of stuff, I like really layered stuff. I think that, for example, when all the layers start going in this song, if you just like, I tried an experiment where I just skipped forward to a part where all the layers were going, where, you know, you had two guitars, vocals, two sets of backing vocals, all that kind of stuff. And it sounded cacophonous. But I put up such a fuss, and now you're you know, if you just jump into it, right? But I think they actually earn it in this song, where I think they set up each of those things individually and they bring it together at the end. You know, looking back at this album and what I listened to today, I think it makes a lot of sense to me, at least. I said I like very layered things where they kind of each thing works together. I also love dissonance, which they do a little bit in this song, that they kind of use that to create a little bit of that darkness, kind of that slightly off emotional feel in this song.
There's one, this is another part where I'm like, I'm sorry. Are they serious? The vocal styles on, I guess it's kind of the chorus when he says, I don't understand why you've got that in your hand. He's trying, it sounds, to be a little more like punk or like guttural, and maybe it's because of his age when they recorded this album, but to me it sounds like that 12-year-old kid who sits at the lunch table with you that can kind of do the like funny funny voices. To me it just struck me as like it came off as funny instead of like serious, and I don't think they meant it that way.
No, I don't think so. Yeah,
in the song, but
that's fair.
Yeah, I just had my notes on that. I don't think that style works for him. I agree with you. I think he does have a good voice for a lot of this. When he gets kind of doing that style, yeah, not so much for me. What's the song about?
Yeah, so there's kind of two ways I want to dive into the lyrics on this. One of them is kind of more of an overall way before we get to what the song is actually about. When I read the lyrics, they're very, to me, kind of stream of consciousness. You know, especially this song, Adam's Bomb, Goodbye, Fight, obviously to some extent the whole album, but those songs especially, I think that trying to figure out what they mean is honestly more like having a counseling session with the lyricist more than breaking down a thought out narrative. And I say that because it honestly feels very similar to a way I used to write around this time in my life. I would basically just think up a situation, kind of let myself fall into that situation kind of in a mental state, and then just write whatever comes out. Probably for young Clifton, that was a way of kind of like pseudo counseling session for myself, you know, dealing with my anxieties at the time. I think it's more interesting, honestly, what he's writing about than what he's writing.
Yeah, and it's called Aubrey's Fall. So what is her fall?
Right. So the song is about a friend, a woman, which I think is important to note because we're going to come back to this later and also another song, who has decided to be cool and maybe develops a drinking problem. Yeah. Yep. until our protagonist puts up a fuss, that's a direct quote from the song, and she gives up drinking and rejoins the friend group. Then the closing kind of like bridge thing on the outro thing is about how other people don't believe that she's changed, but he can tell that it's real.
Am I crazy, or is there a similar kind of theme or idea in one of the All-Star United songs that we looked at? Was there something like this?
Yeah, there's the song, there's Drive, which was about driving around with a friend who things weren't going well with. A little bit, yeah. But not, okay. Not, I mean, it has the same, there's a feel, right? There's a
kind yeah, of thing going on. I think there. we're probably going to see this again in the future in other albums.
Oh, yes.
Drinking is bad, turn your life around, yes. Get your life straight. Yeah.
Now, I want to say that 15, 16-year-old Clifton didn't have a full grasp on the fact that this was a drinking problem. There's the lines, I don't understand why you've got that in your hand, why you've got that in your glass. I remember the time thinking, oh, what does she have in her glass? But it's just alcohol, which is kind of boring, honestly. It's kind of disappointing. Yeah.
Could have been cooler.
Yeah, it could have been cooler. I don't know what, but I didn't write the song. It's not my job. You know, I can't help but judge it from my modern perspective, which is unfair because, like I said, I definitely wrote stuff like this where I was a shitty person too, right?
Right.
But a guy writing a song about a woman who is weak for having a drinking problem and that then he saves her by throwing a fuss is gross.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe it really happened. But I don't think so.
Nope. And we're going to touch. I have a question that keeps coming up in my mind, but we're going to touch on it with another song with that. So I'll leave it.
Yeah. Also, I don't know that this is necessarily a Christian thing. The scene that these guys were in at the time was a very, there's a very strong straight edge.
Yeah, and I think Bloodshed even said they were straight edge for a while.
Right, so the guy, Jeff DeCoy from Unashamed was straight edge. The Bloodshed guys were straight edge at this time. So I don't know if this judginess, I don't even know if you can blame this judginess on religion, but it's, you know, it is still.
Good point.
Yeah. The sexism is more problematic to me than the judginess in this song, honestly.
Yeah. And we're going to get back to the sexism in just a couple songs.
We will.
Can we talk about Sean's song?
Yeah.
Like,
why is it called Sean's song, for example?
Yeah, well, there's that, which also this is an album where it made me think a bunch of different people are writing the lyrics. Just the way the lyrics are on the songs, they're very different in style. Mm. This made me think maybe Sean wrote this. But like, what the hell is going on in this song?
I don't know.
Is this a true story? I don't think so.
No.
What is the metaphor that I'm missing? Because I read it a few times and was like, is he trying to make some deeper meaning? I'm having trouble with this. This is another one of those where I was like, okay.
I mean, it's pretty simple, Jake.
All right, help me out, Clifton.
Grandpa was a liar. Grandpa was a crook. I forget the rest of the song. But
But Johnny never knew.
Johnny never knew. That's correct. Johnny never knew. So there's two characters, Grandpa and Johnny. None of them are called Sean. Yeah, I don't know. It's a weird song.
Well, and it's he fun. Says, bang, it's bang, kind of you're dead. 50 bullets in your head. Gotta do what Grandpa said.
Yeah.
And this is one where I definitely felt like there was some of those filler parts because he says, yeah, come on, bring it on down. And I'm like, okay, he's just filling space. Mm-hmm.
There's also a little ska in this song.
Yeah, this was another one of those songs that was not helping me like take this album super seriously.
Yeah, well, you know, so Rainy Days shows up one other time that I can find on Underground 101, which is a compilation.
Mm-hmm.
Came out in like 98 or something like that. The Rainy Days song on that compilation is a ska song.
Okay. Yeah. Let me jump back to the lyrics in case people haven't heard this.
Sure.
Because basically it's Johnny's grandpa calls for Johnny and says he needs help, but these bums are outside, which using the term bums is anyway, aside from that. Johnny comes, Johnny has his gun, but they gun poor Johnny down right outside of grandpa's house.
Mm-hmm.
And Johnny never knew that grandpa was a crook and mm-hmm. grandpa was a liar.
Mm-hmm.
I have, again, no idea what's going on here.
Yeah.
Why it's called Sean's song, who Johnny is, what is going on.
I think that it's a song that you can listen to and it's a good song, you know, it's fine. But it's not one of the songs I wanted to talk about because it's kind of a weird song. I don't know.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about it because it was weird. Yep. Well, let's skip ahead to Adam's bomb. Mm-hmm.
which I think is a great song.
Yeah, but the style of it I kind of like, but this is another one where I started looking at the lyrics going, what are they talking about? And also, did you notice there...
Oh, it's just about losing control.
There were guns in the previous song we were just mentioning. There's guns in this one. Oh, this is that very, like, militant kind of...
Oh, yeah.
Masculine gun type thing going on. But this song is basically, I don't know, it makes it sound like he blew up the world.
Yep.
He ran up to his room and unleashed a bomb and blew it up, but he's going to blame it on his parents. This song had one of those kind of pre-songs to it, like you're mentioning. I looked it up, and he's quoting old-fashioned jump rope rhymes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so maybe you already knew this. talking about Spanish Dancer and then Teddy Bear. Mm-hmm.
Spanish Dancer, do the split. Teddy Bear, Teddy Bear, turn around. Teddy Bear, Teddy Bear.
I have no idea why.
Nope.
What that has to do with anything, but... yeah, it's in the song. Did you already know that ahead of time?
No, not until you sent it to me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, that's not one thing I looked at when I was a kid. No. Although I like it, like it's a kind of fun intro, and then there's a tambourine in the pre-song. And then whoever's playing the tambourine drops it, and just bam, the song starts, and that's, I thought it was really fun. Oh, by the way, this is one of the two songs on the demo we're going to talk about later, because there was a demo before this album.
Oh,
and it's pretty much in the same, it's pretty much, I mean, obviously this is recorded way better, because we're going to talk about that, but it's pretty much the same as the demo version. The lyrics are the same, the vocals are a little different.
Let's go on to Goodbye.
So this is probably my favorite song on the album, especially from the time. I know, I saw your notes, you hate it.
This is my least favorite.
It's yes, okay. I know. I think the song kind of brings together, you know, all the elements I've been touching on, the guitars, the vocals, the backing vocals. I think they all kind of come together in an interesting way in this, in a very layered, kind of quirky, kind of, this is the other dark song on the album, in addition to Aubrey's Fall. And it's a song about, you know, having to say goodbye to a friend that's going in a different direction than you. I think it pulls off that fairly well. As I mentioned earlier, I remember at the time when I was a kid thinking that this was kind of a judgy song. Having gone back through the lyrics, I don't think that's true. At least not as judgy as I thought at first. It does start off judgy in the same way that Aubrey's Fall does, but there's the line, "Where were you when I needed you so much?" And kind of in the end, the protagonist develops empathy for what the other person's going through, and they kind of patch things up based on that.
Well, let me talk about my take on the lyrics and then one thing with the music in this song. This is another example. Why is it always women who are going astray?
Yeah, no, that is
right. We saw that earlier. We saw that here. I'm pretty sure it was the same on the All Star United album. I think we're going to see it again. I really didn't, and I know my wife would probably roll her eyes right now if she could hear me saying this, but like, I had no idea how misogynistic like so much of this stuff was. And I don't think these guys necessarily knew that they were. I don't think know that they are today or anything
that. It's not actively misogynistic.
It's just like, that's the culture.
It is the culture. I remember at the time my youth pastor lecturing us guys. And I think probably the girls probably got the same lecture, honestly, you know, about kind of being like a knight in shining armor or whatever, you know, kind of rescuing the girl kind of thing, and that it's not realistic. I think we're seeing an evangelical and a very American evangelical interpretation of the knight in shining armor here, you know.
Definitely. Yeah. That was definitely a kind of real prominent idea of the man is this hero, and women always were in need of saving.
Yeah,
which really stood out on these two songs.
Yeah, and I'll be kind of open here in that, in my own shittiness at the time, there was a girl I liked had a small period where she went through kind of the same kind of thing, where, like, you know, drinking and that kind of stuff. And I remember thinking about the same time, like, I really need to save her. You know,
right?
If only I could be there for her, it'd probably all be okay.
I did think the song had probably the worst moment on the album. I just said the chorus sounds like really bad, jangly Christian music of the 90s. You know how worship leaders, I swear, it's just all I can remember from like late 90s Christianity, any worship song. I'm not a guitar player, but they would play it like, it's just super jangly. They're strumming it way more than they need to.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like that's a little bit of the chorus on this, and he's getting kind of loud.
you know that song Shane and Shane?
Right. Yeah, yeah, that group. Yeah, exactly like that.
So there was a group in the late 90s that did kind of worship, acoustic worship type stuff called Shane and Shane. They were, I think they wanted to be Jars of Clay, for example, you know?
Right.
But kind of what they were known for was just playing acoustic guitar really, really fast.
Yep.
Look, I see, I know where you're coming from. I will say, for example, the first time I heard Tollycraft, I dismissed them because it was jangly guitar pop. And I was like, fuck that shit.
Right.
And it took me a long time to get over that. And I love jingly guitar pop now. I don't like Shane and Shane because they, you know. And I get where you're coming from here, but there's plenty of jingly guitar pop out there that's amazing and good. And I don't think you can necessarily say that this is that.
No, it just reminded me of it. It was just for those brief seconds in the chorus of the song where I was really like, woo, too much.
Yeah. And I understand it.
In fact, the chorus of this song to me sounds very different than most of the rest of the album. They seem to really deviate on this song from kind of the way the rest of the album sounded. Well, let's go to what I assume was your favorite song at the time, or maybe just one you liked a lot, The Last Voyage of Sir Patrick Spens.
Yeah. So there's a fake false start on this. Did you notice that?
Yep, at the end of the previous song.
What's I don't know, that kind of annoyed me. To the point that I went back to the demo, because this is the other song that's on the demo. I went back to the demo to see if it had a real false start in it, and it does not. I don't have a lot to say about this song. Obviously, I really like the story. It's an old ballad about a sailor who is sent a letter from the king to go on a certain seafaring trip at a bad time of year, and he doesn't like the fact that someone told the king that he can do this, but he does it anyways because it's the king, and you do what the king says, and of course everyone dies. It's actually based on two real sets of events, I think around like the 1100s, about some Scottish nobles sailing over to Norway and not making it. And I think it was princesses both times, actually, that were being ferried back and forth. They all died together.
What about the song did you like the most? Was it the story? Was it the music? What about it?
Yeah, obviously I liked the story at the time. I think the music is pretty good too. Kind of what happens on the song musically, the two guitars kind of go back and forth to take turns between being rhythm and lead on this song. Kind of a lot of interchanging of what's going on, which I think was really interesting. And I think they did a pretty interesting job of taking this old ballad and putting it to music, because there's no music to this. So they put it to music, and I think they did a very good job of keeping it interesting and of putting it to music in such a way that it kind of highlighted the tragedy of the story and kind of told the story pretty well.
Yeah, no, they did do a good job putting it to music. I just wanted to bring up The Gunslinger, mainly because this is a song I definitely always just skipped over because you can't really understand what they're saying.
Which is interesting.
And it's kind of almost like, what would you say, like a not spoken word, but almost, but it really kind of distorted vocals.
This is probably the most put together lyrics on the entire album.
Right.
And the vocals are distorted to the point that you cannot understand them at all.
Yeah, which now looking at your reference that you pulled up, I mean, it looks like it came from, is that Stephen King, The Dark Tower?
Yeah, so it's based on a Stephen King and Marvel comic book series called The Gunslinger.
Which makes me wonder if maybe they were ashamed of that or trying to hide it a little bit because it wasn't completely Christian.
I don't think so.
Or maybe not. I don't know.
Maybe they were just doing it for the feel. I have no clue.
But the thing it made me think of as I was reading through the lyrics, especially when they said, Satan, the accursed, bring him down. And I don't know if you clicked on the link I put in the notes.
Oh, yes, I did.
Did it remind you at all of what I'm thinking of? Or no? Do you know the song that I'm referencing?
I block out Carmen as much as I can.
Okay, well, it made me think of Carmen, Satan, Bite the Dust, which is basically Carmen, basically kind of like this, you know, having a, what do they call it, like a shootout.
No.
You know.
That's mean.
With the devil, and, you know. Which we should probably talk about Carmen another. I mean, good God, we could spend tons of episodes on Carmen. I know, you're right. It is kind of mean, but it's just what I thought of with this. And again, though, it does fit kind of that militant, masculine Christianity thing. I know this is more based on the comic book.
Yes, it is.
But I guess the feel of it still kind of fit with everything they're doing on this album.
Yeah.
The other one that is listed as the last song on the album, but I know there's a hidden track we're going to talk about, is Lord, I Want to Know, mm-hmm. which I think is an old hymn
or a song.
And this is another one that just kind of seemed like a joke. Like they did a slow version of it, but then they did a fast version at the end. Also kind of, to me, seemed a little bit like filler. Like, oh, we need to stick another song on there. Let's do that. I don't know.
I thought it sounded very sincere.
Okay.
Also, this song got stuck in my head. Of all the songs, this song got stuck in my head.
I'm sorry. It's funny. We're so opposite takes on almost all these songs on this album. Okay, so I'll tell everybody. I had to ask Clifton when I was listening to this on Spotify, because I didn't have the album. I was asking him this, Lord, I Want to Know, is that the hidden track? Because he told me it's a hidden track, and he said no. And then when you ripped it, it looks like there's actually 99 tracks.
Okay, so there's... After Lord, I Want to Know You More, which is, what, track 14 or 15?
Yeah, something like that.
14. There are 74 20-second long tracks, culminating on track 89, which is 13 minutes and 53 seconds of silence. All of these are silent, by the way.
Right.
Then there's 10 tracks, 10 seconds each, of just unbearable noises stacked on top of each other, which sounds like the bell at a train track crossing.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I listened to only like two of them.
Yeah, kind of a bass just tapping out two notes, somebody saying something in a creepy way with a lot of like reverb, random guitar noises. I don't know. And then about 2.5 minutes in, someone says, thank you, and kind of all the noises kind of slowly fade out. That's it.
Any thoughts on that?
Why? Yeah. Why?
I mean, it's kind of fun. I mean, that was the thing that we don't really experience today, hidden tracks. It's kind of fun, but usually I would like to be a little more rewarded for the effort I put into listening to it.
Exactly. You have to look, there is... 20 minutes of silence before you get to 2.5 minutes of god-awful noise.
So give me your overall thoughts on this then.
Okay, so I want to talk about the demo first, because
sure,
you sent over a demo, a Rainy Days demo, which you found somehow through your magic means.
Okay.
There's only two tracks that are common. I mentioned Adam's Bomb and The Last Voyage of Sir Patrick Spence. It is rough. I mean, the original core recording is obviously pretty bad, and the digitizing of it wasn't much better. And that's not what I'm talking about when I say it was rough. I don't think I would have let these guys record an album, having heard that demo.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that again fits a little bit with my take on the album, which is just, I mean, I think it's 96. It may have been 95 when they record this. I don't know.
Mm.
Tooth and Nail is kind of blown up
all of a sudden.
Yeah. And so I've got a sense of whoever at Alarma saw that, like, oh, guys from Bloodshed and Unashamed are making a new band, may have not even heard them, like, seriously, and was like, do you want us to put out your album? And they're probably like, yeah. And I, to me, that explains a lot of this album. I don't know, you may disagree on that, but just because the songs, there's a lot of variety. Some stuff feels like it's not completely fleshed out. I would have been interested to hear like a follow-up album from them.
Yes.
Because I think they would have ironed stuff out more and kind of developed more of a style. That's kind of was my take. It was just like kind of Alarma threw some money at them and said, you want to do this? And I know it was on in a minute, but also like the packaging on this was fairly nice. Like, I mean, it's an actual booklet.
Someone did it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about the Mike Knott album last time, and that's just a little fold, just a, whatever you call it, bifold type thing. This is a full-on book stapled together.
Yeah.
It wasn't done on the cheap. Yeah, I don't know. What are your overall thoughts?
I don't know. I have so many questions about this album and about where Rainy Days came from. I mean, we know who's in it, obviously. I know they're playing shows at the time. If you read through the thanks, they mention, thinking people come out to shows. Maybe someone from Frontline heard them, maybe they didn't. It's hard to say. My guess is that they had somewhat of a following, at least. But I have so many questions.
Go ahead. What are they?
No, I want to know, I mean, you know, what led to the band starting, you know, how long was the band together before they decided to record an album. I want to know about the choices on the guitar tone, which to me is really interesting. I think it really paints a lot of this album and how this album comes together. It's hard to respond to that because I don't know. I just have so many questions. Now, that said, I don't think we necessarily disagree on what we're hearing. I think we're hearing the same thing and having a different interpretation of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right. So let me tell you what my interpretation of the overall on this album is. The first time I noticed this consciously was on Broken Social Scene's album, Broken Social Scene, their self-titled album, which I think came out in like 2005. That album has this certain kind of energy to it where it feels to me like all the songs have been practiced just enough so they aren't old to anybody, but not so much that they become boring.
Okay.
And it gives it kind of this kind of raw urgency, kind of like a naked excitement and kind of like a childlike wonder at making music, where it always feels like everything could fall apart at any moment. It sounds like whoever is performing this, whoever wrote this, barely has control of this song. And I think that you get that kind of rawness on this album. So I get where you're coming from. I don't think the album's unfinished. I've listened to unfinished albums before, and this is not one of those. Could it have been developed more? Absolutely. But I don't think it's unfinished, and I don't think that's necessarily fair to say. I think the silliness isn't due to lack of effort so much as just, to me, it's an expression of the artist. So yeah, I like it. I think it has some nice layered complexity. You know, and in the end, it's a punk album that manages to be beautiful. Another question I had is Unashamed and Blood Cheddar on Tooth and Nail. So why is this on Alorma?
I feel like I know the answer to that, but I don't like this album as much as you. My take is just that it probably a couple of things. One, I don't know that they'd know what to do with it. I don't know that Alorma definitely didn't know what to do with it.
Oh,
either.
No.
It's not rockabilly. I agree with you there. But I think that's part of it. I think it just maybe wasn't finished enough, or they didn't. Like, it's one of those things. I think if maybe this band had continued and had a second album, that one might have been. I just think they kind of needed to have a little more time together.
And like I said, if I were Brandon Ebel and I heard that demo, I would not have.
Yeah.
I would not have let them record an album.
Any other thoughts on like the artwork or the packaging? I appreciated you scanning it in. I remember the packaging now that I've seen it again, and I did think it was like they did a pretty good job. I like it's kind of like a two-tone color thing.
Yeah, it's close to sepia, but not full on sepia. You know, it's black and white with just a little bit of warmness to it.
And I thought the font on the front and stuff works. Now, trying to read all the lyrics in that font is awful.
Yeah, so in the book, all the lyrics are in the same kind of curly font as on the front, but at 9 points.
Yeah.
And so it is hard to read.
On the front, again, it looks fine, even on the back, but it was a bad choice.
Yes, I agree.
For the inside. But I kind of liked how each person got their own thank you page with their picture and stuff. Like, it's not a bad layout. And if I remember correctly, the inside of the CD, like the actual CD holder case part is white, and the CD itself is white too. That had some thought put into it. It wasn't bad.
It's very nicely packaged. My only problem with it, so the front cover for the album, you know, given that this is kind of a dark and quirky album, I think that picture of them kind of sitting together in like pinstripe suits and the hats with flowers and whatnot and kind of looking dejected, it goes well with the album. But, you know, if this was on Tooth and Nail, I would have bought that in a second. But given that this was on Alorma and I saw that if I hadn't seen the sticker that said Bloodshed and Unashamed, I would have passed it over probably for months.
Yeah, I agree with you. Good point.
But I can't say that it's a bad album cover, but it definitely wouldn't have gotten me. It would have taken me a while to listen to it. It would have gone to the back of my list for things to listen to if it wasn't for that sticker.
For sure. Well, to finish up, where are they now? Do you know anything about that?
Some of them. So Sean McCauley, the vocalist, he has a new band called Oliver House. It's on Bandcamp if you want to find it. Oliver House is exactly how it sounds, two words. He also posts on Quora, which I really like. I'm a big fan of Quora. I don't know. Other than that, I don't know. Jason Fleetwood on guitar. Like I said, he's in a book now called Windowsill Audrey. That was in 2007. It looks like it may or may not still be going. It's hard to say. You can find it on Bandcamp, though. Sean Stopnick on guitar. His newest band is Rock Kills Kid, and you can find that on Bandcamp. Jeff Jacoy on bass, and who was the lead singer for Unashamed, has a solo project these days. I don't think he's recording albums so much as he just records a song every once in a while when he feels like it, and you can find random things on Bandcamp. And most interesting, Jason Feltman, the drummer, it looks like him, and it's the same name, same face shape. I think he has a podcast called The Insurance Dudes.
Really?
That is indeed about selling insurance.
Okay. Would never have guessed that one.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, as best as I can tell, that's where they are now.
We've been trying to give each album an award. Do you have one for this one?
I do. I am giving Rainy Days Homecoming the Cotton Eye Joe Award. Because Rainy Days, where did you come from and where did you go? I have so many questions. I need more music.
Oh my god, that's corny.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah, that's my award.
Clifton, what are we listening to next time?
We are going to listen to, and wait for it here, The Adventures of the OC Supertones. We're going to have some fun revisiting old times. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Your Music Saved Us. If you enjoyed your time with us, please leave us a review or share this episode on the social media of your choice, where you can probably follow us at Your Music Saved Us, or email us at yourmusicsavedus@gmail.com. The music in this episode is the work of Rainy Days and is used with apologies, not permission. Please check the show notes to find out how you can buy their music.